we're going to begin, and Howard is going to unmute his phone by pressing star 6 and lead us in direct treatment of a symptom. He may be having trouble unmuting. So what I'll do is I'll start reading.
Everybody.
Oh, hello. There you are.
I didn't hear the muted thing. So anyway, that's my excuse. I'm supposed to be good at technology, but sometimes I'm not. Anyway, hi, everybody, and welcome to our 10th session of the TiVo book study. And we've got direct treatment of a symptom coming up. I've written an introductory couple of paragraphs at tivo.egbop.com. And as to summarize those, I find this paper to be one of the most difficult in the whole collection. And it's not because it's complicated or hard to understand. It's because it cuts against so much what I believe about AA. It really highlights the difference between psychiatry and 12-step program. And because TiVo is going to say that AA's whole program is about treating a symptom, and that symptom is drinking. And, you know, alarm bells go off in my head when I hear that. But I'm looking at and trying to understand why that's a difference. And I think the difference is what psychiatrists look at for causes of an illness, a mental illness, and what we're looking at for causes of a mental illness. So anyway, that's the beginning. Okay, so I'm going to start. Direct treatment of a symptom. Therapists with alcoholics have a twofold task. They must treat the disease, alcoholism, and they must treat the person afflicted with it. Psychiatrists have tended to bypass the disease and treat the individual. But again and again, under this approach, the patient has proved recalcitrant to all therapeutic endeavor. As a result, alcoholics have been considered very unlikely prospects for therapy of any sort. I should mention that this is, once again, he's talking to his colleagues. It was published in 1973, so it's after his, at or around his death. The difficulty, of course, was in the main symptom of the disease. The fact that the patient would get drunk, which repeatedly nullified all attempts at assistance. As a consequence, work with the person who drank was stymied by the fact that he drank. In the face of this dilemma, therapists have thrown up their hands in dismay and have turned to greener pastures. The mistake we made was our failure to recognize that the task was twofold. In rather doctrinaire fashion, we persisted in treating the alcoholism as a symptom that would be cured or arrested if its causes could be favorably altered. The drinking was something to be put up with as best as one could while more fundamental matters were being studied. The result of this procedure was that very few alcoholics were helped. The drinking continued and the symptom remained untouched. Pass. Any questions on that?
I don't have any questions, but I do have a comment, and the comment is that I'm not surprised that he says that psychiatrists have tended to bypass the disease and treat the individual again and again under this approach. Yeah, patient has proved recalcitrant to all therapeutic endeavor.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Because people who are not aware of recovery or kind of tuned into recovery, and if they're really kind of tuned in to just psychological education, there are some pieces that are really different. And I can see, and for a long time, I mean, alcoholics, even when we in the program work with each other and people are going in and out and in and out, I mean, that's frustrating in itself too. So we have kind of a different way that we end up learning to look at it, but a psychiatrist doesn't necessarily look at his or her professional life in a spiritual
right. Well, that's exactly right, and that's what that paper up on the website. It's what I deal with. I think it's basically, it's the question of causes. He's saying we're treating a symptom, but the causes are being untouched. But that AA treats a symptom all the way through all 12 steps. But from his point of view, that means it's keeping the drinking down, right? And he says he has to get that out of the way in order to do therapy. Which, you know, if you understand it that way, it isn't too bad. It's just a different, you know, what are causes to TBO? Their childhood development or genetic predisposition nowadays is more emphasis on that. And that's it. You know, nature and nurture, that's the scientific view. You know, there's no spirit in that. And it's, you know, it's science. And we're coming along and we're saying this is a spiritual malady, you know, and we think we are treating the cause, and the cause is that we are spiritually bereft, you know, and we need to have a spiritual experience. So, yeah, that's the basic fundamental difference, I think. That's exactly right.
Oh, whoops. I'm going to be sure everybody's muted, so press star 6 if you didn't hear the voice. Sounds like, I'll keep going. In other medical treatment, this concept of getting at causes is not considered sufficient. No one ignores a cancer, for instance, while searching for its origins. It is cut into or treated with X-ray or radium in the hope that the growth will either be removed or will stop advancing. Once the cancer is detected, the question of etiology is academic. Exactly the same thinking applies to the treatment of alcoholism. It is a symptom that becomes dangerous in itself until it has been effectively stopped. Little of real help can be offered. Alcoholics Anonymous stresses the danger of the first drink, and antabuse simply stops the ability to take it. Both attack the symptom, and both have recorded a substantial measure of success. The advent of these new tools not only have given us a means to treating the symptom directly, it has focused attention upon a factor whose importance was thereto insufficiently appreciated. That factor is the significance of the first drink and what it represents to the psyche of the drinker. And first drink is in italics. Such focusing has two results. First, it directs thought towards the problem of stopping, that is, not taking the first drink. Second, it leads to a new approach to the understanding of what must transpire in therapy if the alcoholic is to remain sober. This paper will discuss both these points, namely the direct treatment of a symptom and the individual's reaction to such a direct approach. And I'll stop there. Any comments?
Well, etiology is causes, right? So we're talking about they're not looking at the cause for cancer. They're cutting the cancer out. And he's using that as an analogy with alcoholism.
Thank you. Thanks for pronouncing it correctly, too.
Okay, so any other questions? Comments? Okay. So go ahead.
No, I don't have any.
Okay. The direct treatment of a symptom. The direct treatment of a symptom is and has been the subject of much controversy. A review of the past is necessary to set the controversy in perspective. Roughly, we can divide the past into the time before Freud and the time after. Prior to his epic-making revelations about the unconscious, conscience, and its controlling influence over behavior, all treatment perforce was direct, necessarily perforce means. If a person was acting in a disturbed manner, he was placed in an institution. If he broke the law, he was imprisoned. A naughty child was spanked. Treatment was aimed at behavior and was essentially disciplinary. The big stick. For the most part, it was applied blindly, woodenly, as the only known means of combating the behaviors being encountered. Then, through Freud's work, conduct was recognized as an outgrowth of unconscious functioning. And before long, the field of psychiatry embraced as one of its major tenets the principle that all behavior sprang from the unconscious, and that therapy, when necessary, had its goal the determination and elimination of the pathology behind upsetting behavior. The validity of such shift was indisputable, since former blind methods could be replaced with much more precise measures. Direct treatment of a symptom lost all caste. The day of scientific therapy had arrived. So he's showing the psychiatric approach to mental illness is to look for the unconscious elements that cause a bad behavior. So if they're looking at an alcoholic, the bad behavior is drinking. So they're not looking at the drinking as a problem. They're looking at whatever the unconscious process is. And so that helps me understand what he's talking about in treating a symptom. So, and lost all caste, I believe that is, means just fell out of favor. So, I'll pass.
It's kind of interesting, though, because when you think about, like, it in this sense of, like, bad behavior, so maybe, like, drinking, drinking starts off the bad, drinking can start off the bad behavior, or the bad behavior can start off the drinking. But it seems like you end up with bad some kind type of bad behavior with drinking. You know, when you get to the point of desperation, it's like something is you know, not working, and something's in your mind considered bad.
Right. Well, we have the ego, right?
Right. You know? Yeah.
And so, what are the unconscious underpinnings of the ego? Well, Thiebaud has told us, you know, that it's this infantile ego left over from childhood. So, I think that's where he's looking at causes and conditions. And you know, that's not in the big book. You know, that's something coming from psychiatry. It's coming from his perspective, even though it dovetails really well in my mind, the way I feel, to what the nature of my alcoholism is. So, but it's a shift in perspective. You know, I think he thinks he's dealing with the causes when he deals with the ego. And I would agree with that, you know, and for somebody with an ego like mine, therapy is very useful. I don't want to diss therapy at all. I've availed myself of it quite a lot. But I'm not looking for the spiritual life in that, and it's that's actually what really helps my alcoholism is to move towards the spiritual and away from the material, and in the process reducing that ego. So he's not looking at that. He's not looking at the spiritual experience as ego reducing. Although, you know, he said earlier that I think that the whole process is to keep the ego down. I'm interpreting what he says. And basically, that's why he says it's a treatment of a symptom. All the rest of AA steps are designed to keep the ego in check, from his point of view. And that's treating the symptom of alcoholism. Anyway, it's real confusing for me. But there is this distinct difference. There's so much overlap, too. I may be just doing much ado about nothing. But it's just like the fifth time I've read it, and every time this jumps out for me.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So I'll continue. Strangely, though, a new kind of woodenness then appeared. Anything prior to Freud was out to be viewed dimly and with alarm. I, too, was an early believer and expounder of the theory that all behavior was symptomatic. I, as much as anyone, search energetically for unconscious forces to help alcoholics, and I too fell flat on my face. It just did not work. Then, as related elsewhere, Alcoholics Anonymous came along, and I saw it succeed not only in arresting the drinking, but in helping a person to mature. All my pet assumptions were knocked into a cocked hat, and it took me many a year to realize the full import of what I had seen happen to my patient as she made the grade through Alcoholics Anonymous. Unconcerned with causes and not bewitched by dogma, the AA program was designed to get the individual to stop drinking and really nothing else. The aspects of personality inventory and of spiritual growth were useful in AA, chiefly because they tended to ensure the individual's capacity for not taking the first drink. They had nothing to do with causation. The whole program was direct treatment of a symptom. I want to just kind of go back for a minute because there was something that stood out to me back here, and that was when he says, then as related elsewhere, Alcoholics Anonymous came along, and I saw it succeed not only in arresting the drinking, but in helping a person to mature. And I really like the part that he added, that it helps people to mature. Because, mm-hmm. like, an abuse isn't helping a person mature. Mm-hmm. If you look at, like, the food programs, if you just go on a diet, mm-hmm. you may lose weight, but it doesn't help you to mature. Same with, you know, just stopping drinking. You know, you see that. Too, you know, you hear about a dry drunk. And I think that's what's so amazing about the 12 steps is that the focus is on a spiritual awakening. So what's a spiritual awakening? It's a change of behavior. And I think I'm pleased that he really notes that in this part of the reading. And
he acknowledges that, but then he turns around right away and says some of the most difficult things for me to understand, which is that A is unconcerned with causes and not bewitched by dogma. He's talking about psychiatric dogma there, that we have to psychoanalyze you before you can stop drinking. And the AA program is designed to get the individual to stop drinking. And that's very true, right? I mean, up front. And step one. The spiritual growth and the personality inventory were useful in AA chiefly because they tended to ensure the individual's capacity for not taking the first drink. So he's seeing all of that as treating the symptom. The whole program was a direct treatment of the symptom. So this is exactly what I've been talking about. You know, he's looking at... He's looking at AA's goal as being to stop drinking, and essentially that's the basic error, I think. You know, the point of the program is to have a spiritual experience.
Yeah, and then what he does in the last, well, for me, it's on 91, it's the last paragraph. He says, unconcerned with causes and not bewitched by dogma, the AA program was designed to get the individual to stop drinking and really nothing else. So that isn't, exactly the way that we look at it. And then on the next page, when he's saying the aspects of personality inventory and of spiritual growth were useful in AA chiefly because they tended to ensure the individual's capacity for not taking the first drink, they had nothing to do with causation. And I have written on my side, for me, it's like I look at the spiritual malady as, mm-hmm. but I can't really see the spiritual malady. You know, I can see the results of the spiritual malady, but I can't see the spiritual malady. So that's mm-hmm. what I That's what I, you know, see. That's how I understand alcoholism, where I think that's a little different than what he's saying here. Because,
To talk over you, what were you saying?
No, I was just going to say the whole program was direct treatment of a symptom.
So there's a whole different mindset here. Mm-hmm. I mean, he sees all of AA as effective because it keeps people from drinking. And, you know, if it's more than, if our problem is drinking, you know, it's, we should be fine coming out of our first step, right? Stop drinking. But, and I don't think, you know, I'm trying to read Thibault's mind through this, and it's sometimes a little difficult, but it seems to me that he's just basically looking at causes and conditions, etiology, as he says, as being, you know, these unconscious mechanisms. It's the way the psyche, the mind of the alcoholic is structured, right? And, you know, I look at that and I take it, you know, wow, that's good information. But, you know, he's thinking that's the process of recovery. That's the psychiatrist's job, is to go into that domain and be a physician, be a therapist. And, you know, AA, we do inventories, you know, we amend wrongs. All of these things, that kind of looks like therapy, right, on the surface. But it's really not. It's part of a spiritual process leading towards a spiritual experience, spiritual awakening. So, you know, it's just we're looking at two different aspects of the same thing. And it really gets down to this whole dichotomy or this split between science and spirit, which I don't think exists. I think they're actually compatible as long as they stick to their own domains. And, you know, so, but I have to understand that Thibault is coming from that point of view in order to be able to get anything out of this. Because, you know, personally, that stuff stops me. You know, I go and I look at that and I say, wait, that's wrong. And there's actually a lot of value here. But so I have to open my mind up. And, you know, I had to understand a little better what he was doing.
Can I make a comment on that?
You bet.
Now, I'm not as well versed in this stuff as you guys. Matter of fact, I know very little about it, but I've really learned a lot, and I've enjoyed these discussions. I've learned a lot. But I think what it sounds like to me that he was saying, and like I said, I don't understand it on the level you guys do. But what I hear him saying is that basically everything we're doing in AA is to keep us from drinking. And the way I relate that to myself is, you know, I love working with others, and I go make amends when I've harmed others and I've taken the inventory. But all of the steps for me is because of my first step. I don't want to drink again. And I'm not saying that every time I work with others is just so I won't drink. But at the end of the day, if I knew I'd never drink again or I could control my drinking, I probably wouldn't do half the stuff I do with the steps or in AA, just to be honest. Why would I put in all of that effort if it wasn't for, I really believe I have the illness of alcoholism, I don't want to drink, and all of the steps to me are on that foundation.
Well, that's a bottom line, isn't it? Interesting.
So I'm obviously just wondering if that's what he's saying. Pretty much that the reason we do all of this is to keep us from drinking.
You're probably right. Sounds right to me. It's hard, once again, trying to read his mind through his words. But, yeah, that sounds, you know, I think.
And I could be wrong. I don't know it like you guys do. But that's what it sounded like to me.
I think, yeah. Well, you heard that, and I didn't, because I've got a different attitude towards this. And it's a blessing that you're here, because that perspective is, you know, I fly up in the clouds, right, and to get my feet back on the ground, and that is, you know, cessation of drinking. But you know what all goes with that, you know, is the rest of the program, which is spiritual in nature. But so, I mean, eventually, you know, I want to stay sober no matter what. Put the plug in the jug. But I'm really about living my life in a spiritual way, you know, and helping other people and, you know, doing step work and reading this stuff and thinking about it and, you know, all sorts of things I do, prayer and meditation is designed for me to be able to live a spiritual life. And I have a hard time doing that. But AA helps me. That approach really helps me. The
12-step
helps.
And for myself, like, I would probably have a harder time doing it if I knew my life didn't depend on it.
Yeah. Well, right. There's that medical sledgehammer that we're doomed.
Yeah.
I know if I take a drink and finally get going, I'm done. Totally.
Yeah,
done.
Me too.
So that's a great motivator. And yeah, right. So I can see how Tiba would see that as the whole thing. And it is, in a way. It is. I mean, it's a bottom line that we have to pay attention to, right? You know, it's like nothing happens before you stop drinking. You know, it's like, you know, and he's seeing that in his therapy. He can't talk to his patients, can't get through to them. He's going to go ahead and give details about another sort of case study of a guy who was a relapser. And he's going to just show how he uses this idea of treating the symptom first. And I see in that, you know, he's doing a lot of the things that we do too. I think these things dovetail, you know. They're related to one another. They're not the same. So thank you for that perspective. That was very, very good, interesting and useful way to look at that, Lee. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Can I make one more point about that?
Mm-hmm.
It's whenever I sponsored some guys and whenever someone relapses and they end up in the hospital or whatever, I always remind my guys, I always say, you know, we have the same illness they do, and this is why we have to continue this stuff. Mm-hmm. And because we're drinkable. And that's why I thought of that, because of that very reason. I love the spiritual life. I love the fellowship and I really enjoy inventory. I like getting down to causes and conditions, and I like working with others. We got this Kentucky BBA group going, and it's my highlight of my whole week. But I don't want to drink again is the bottom line.
Uh-huh.
So, all right, that did, Horace.
Cool. Do you have any comments?
Yeah, I have one comment, and that was when you were talking about Tebow and the way that he was kind of looking at this. What dawned on me is that, you know, there are people who go through the steps, and they'll go through all of the steps, and you know, and they're not drinking, but they're still unhappy about something, or you know, and I was definitely there too. You know, I worked the steps a lot of times before I found a process that just really showed me a spiritual experience. But that if I'm working the steps and just having an intellectual experience more than a spiritual, and if nobody is knows any other way, and if we're all looking at this in an academic way, which was what I was doing for a very long time, just because I didn't really know how to read the big book, and no one around me really knew how to read the big book, so we were kind of blind leading the blind, and so that's what made me think of what's happening with Thibaut, is that because Thibaut's not going through the work like we're going through the work and having an experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, thanks.
Yeah, that's a great comment, too. So, I mean, he's not an alcoholic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he just has a different mindset, you know, a scientific mindset. Still, there's a lot of overlap, you know, and a lot of value in both ways. So, great comments. So, are we on
Anabuse.
Anabuse came along to confirm the soundness of tackling the symptom, and the need to find an explanation for that heretical fact became more imperative. So it's heresy to say that treating a symptom is going to work. So he's going to try to find out why. Finally, the significance of the first drink became apparent, and then the corollary fact that the individual must stop taking even one. With the recognition that was the goal of both methods, pre-Freud direct management of symptoms took on a different significance. This, too, is to be seen as an effort to change the individual's behavior, either by putting him in an institution for the mentally ill, or by jailing him, or by inflicting punishment. To be sure, these techniques might be applied without much precision and perhaps too often, but they nevertheless effectively stopped the symptoms, and perhaps that in and of itself was not only useful but necessary. Certainly, insofar as helping the alcoholic was concerned, the direct method worked. In my eyes, such treatment had been reestablished as a sound clinical procedure and a valid tool. Hopefully, it could be applied with more skill and finesse now that the Freudian insights were available. But to dismiss it totally would be inexcusable rigidity and evidence of very unscientific dogmatism. Okay, so that makes me a little uncomfortable too. But he talks about, drying out and stuff like that. But shall I go on?
Yeah, you can go on. I just wanted to say that it just shows us that, you know, people can stop when they're put in an institution or when they're jailed, but it doesn't keep them stopped.
Yeah. Yep. So the individual's reaction. With the acceptance of the validity of the direct approach, the treatment of the alcoholic individual takes on a new dimension. Instead of determining causes, the therapeutic aim is directed towards helping the patient to utilize available techniques, AA, Anabuse, and or psychiatry, to aid in his battle to stop drinking. The therapist, so to speak, has his prescription. His job is to sell it to the patient. At this point, we run into a fundamental issue. Most patients take their doctor's prescription. Very few alcoholics respond that simply. As a result, the doctor has the task of inducing the patient to take the medicine offered, and it is here that we must consider the nature of the alcoholic and the individual who balks at taking the remedy suggested. This brings us to our second point, namely, the nature of the individual who so stubbornly refuses to stop drinking. So, over to you, Suzanne.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that new dimension has to be, the person has to be willing to follow directions. Otherwise, you have this stubbornly refuses to stop drinking or gets into some kind of stubborn behavior where they're the working of the steps isn't precise. So more accurately, the topic of this section is the nature of an individual's reaction to direct treatment, the physician for the alcoholic, regardless of his personal inclinations or his theoretical convictions about the function of the therapist, is placed in the role of someone who is trying to stop the patient's drinking. And although the alcohol may desperately want help, the alcoholic may desperately want help consciously, this does not necessarily overcome his unconscious resistance to such authoritative handling. The therapist individually acts as a depriving person, and that's why I think when it says in though the alcoholic may desperately want help consciously, this does not necessarily overcome his unconscious resistance. And why this, I think the set-aside prayer is so good, because we're asking for a new, you know, for a new way to look at something.
And this all dovetails with his, you know, his notion of ego, you know, and what is stopping the alcoholic from accepting help.
Mm-hmm.
Is this unconscious resistance. So he's nodding towards that.
To try to avoid that role is silly, misleading, and a very poor example. Silly because it denies the obvious, and misleading because it's attempting to sugarcoat an unpalatable truth. A poor example because the therapist is denying reality, behavior at which the patient is already expert. Fundamental respect can never be established on such a false basis.
I apologize for that.
Oh, okay.
But a poor example because the therapist is denying reality, behavior at which the patient is already expert. We're good at denying reality.
Yeah, absolutely. As a consequence, the therapist must not fight the patient's identification of him as a depriving figure. There is no loophole from that position. The only hope is to help the patient learn to accept deprivation and therefore reach a state in which, as a mature person, he will realize that all his wants and demands cannot be satisfied and that there are some things he cannot have. The therapist must, and this is all in italics, the therapist must not sidestep his depriving role. Instead, he must freely acknowledge it and let therapy begin right there. Now it goes back to regular type. To do so clears the atmosphere and paves the way for establishing a sound working relationship. The following clinical material shows not only these new tactics must be adopted, but also the patient's reaction to them. The patient is a man in his middle 30s, who after 6 years of stumbling success with AA, decided to try psychiatry because, to quote him, "I'm almost as bad as when I started with AA. I've got to do something." It was clear that he was strongly motivated and consequently he was accepted for therapy. The patient was told that his immediate problem was drinking and that it could ruin his chances of profiting from assistance. There would be no insistence on total sobriety, but there would be the following stipulation. If, in my opinion, his drinking was interfering with therapy, I could require him to take Ambuce, which would ensure sobriety over a period long enough to settle whether or not he could profit from treatment, so that later on he might be able to get along without the medication. The patient promptly accepted this proviso, saying it made complete sense to him. On the surface, he seemed completely receptive. He remarked in confirmation, "I know when I'm drinking it would be a waste of your time to try to help me. I just wouldn't get a thing." No trace of protest could be observed, and I am sure none was felt. In fact, the patient seemed to welcome a forthright statement of what lay before him. he at least knew where he stood. Also, during the first interview, the patient was asked to record his dreams. At the next session, he reported the following: one, irritated and tensed.
Teased.
Maybe what I'll do is I'll stop before I get into the dream. Let's maybe we can make comments if anybody has any comments or wants to pull out or ask any questions about what I've read so far.
I think the meat of what he's doing is saying that you have to be, that the alcoholic has to be stopped. We've seen that in earlier papers, right? That the ego wants to move ahead and dislikes being stopped, in fact, rebels at being stopped, the alcoholic ego. So he's saying the alcoholic must be stopped. Some way, they must stop drinking one way or another. So, you know, for us, for me, you know, the consequences of my drinking were enough, you know. But, you know, people come in and out, and those consequences don't seem to do it. At some point, you know, it's brass tacks. You have to face the necessity to quit, stop drinking. And so he's doing that up front with his patient. He's saying, you got to stop or this won't work. And he's getting agreement. But he puts the kind of the warning, no trace of protest could be observed. And I'm sure none was felt. So that implies that he thinks something's going on under the surface, like in the unconscious.
Would you like to continue reading?
Sure. This is a rather bizarre set of dreams. So so he had three dreams. And one, irritated and teased pet bird. Two, vaguely remembered X.Y, thought he was drinking with him. Three, accidentally pulled all the tail feathers out of pet bird. The first dream he then expanded, adding, the pet bird was mine, and it was caged and visibly annoyed. Little imagination is required to read the unconscious thoughts at this point. Birds stand for freedom, i.e. free as a bird. A caged bird is not free and is therefore is irritated and visibly annoyed. Feelings that every freedom-loving person would show if caged. And no one would deny that a caged bird was a stopped one. The first dream pinpoints the fact that therapy was designed to stop drinking. The next dream finds the patient drinking with a boon companion, a person he was prone to turn to after sobriety had begun to pall. In this dream, quite literally, the bird becomes the patient, escaped from the cage. And the cage that has been escaped from is the knowledge about the danger of the first drink. So he, the patient, being the bird, has flown the coop. Third one is, the report of the third dream also received interesting amplification. The patient volunteered that the bird flew by him, and that as it did, he grabbed it and pulled every last tail feather off, and that all was left was a bare little butt. Twitch of the finger, and I'm off. Pulled every last tail feather off, and all that was left was a bare little butt end. Again, the message of the dream is clear. The free bird, again in the picture, presents its butt end to the world, an unequivocal gesture of defiance. The story that these dreams have to tell seems unambiguous. The patient is coming for help about his alcoholism, which he knows can be treated only by his not taking the first drink. The symbol of the caged and annoyed bird is a brilliant condensation of three aspects of his own self as it reacts to his new situation. First, the bird is a symbol of freedom. Second, it represents the sense of restriction, which is the cage. And third, it shows the visible annoyance and frustration that the bird feels as it is confronted by the fact that it is not at liberty. In the second dream, the patient is no longer stopped. The third dream reveals this clearly as a defiant response to therapy. So that last one, okay, Tivo. It's fine. I don't know what to make of it. The first two, it makes perfect sense to me. No doubt other interpretations with which I would have no dispute may be offered for these dreams. The point is, however, that the theme of stopping is also unmistakably present in the patient's unconscious, which shows a completely understandable reaction to the idea of being stopped and frustrated. Despite the note of defiance in which they end, these dreams actually started therapy off on a good sound basis. First and foremost, the patient learned that he had unconscious attitudes. Although he protested vigorously that he had no feeling of defiance towards either the doctor or the treatment, he knew that on many occasions he had shown and felt just such inner attitudes. He could now appreciate that defiance was in his system, even contrary to his desires, and in spite of his failure to be aware of it. From now on, he would have to recognize the presence of an inner feeling life that psychiatry might help him reach and learn to handle better. Any lurking misgivings regarding psychiatry were to some extent lessened. So that seems to me a significant paragraph. That recognize the presence of an inner feeling life. You know, Primetime AA, which is my home group, we talk about, you know, watching the thoughts that surf the waves of your mind, you know, and it's basically becoming aware of what's going on under there, you know, and knowing that your motivation is coming up deep within, and that's why you need a deep and effective spiritual experience, and you know you need a deep surrender, and it's at that level, at the unconscious level. And Thibaut was saying this earlier, right? So. So this is a significant turn in his description here, I think. Okay, so any comments?
No, I think the dreams, you know, there's so many ways to interpret dreams that, you know, it would be interesting to kind of look at that, just that part from, you know, different kind of schools of thought, but I don't really feel the need to do that right now.
Yeah. Yeah, you could think of the, for instance, and I'll stop after this, you could think of pulling the tail feathers out as preventing the bird from flying, right? But anyway, this sort of shows what Thibaut's thinking is towards his patient, too. So we're understanding the therapeutic process by what Thibaut thinks he's doing and what the response he's getting.
Mm-hmm.
So, want to go on?
Sure. In addition, the patient... Oh, okay. Am I at the right place? In addition, the
you are
patient...
at the right place.
Okay.
That's right.
In addition, the patient had to face the inner demand to be free, and that inside he balked at any curbing. Recognition of this fact was comforting, for it gave him a belief that further insights might be forthcoming and that the possibility of help might exist. Still a third advantage to his start sprang from the discussions of defiance and the insistence upon freedom. The patient's immediate reaction was to scold himself for acting that way and to feel guilty that he had allowed such attitudes to persist. When he could realize that these forces were deep-seated and real, he could drop his punitive reactions of guilt and force upon the most important issue of how he could rid himself of his tendency to defy and his desire to cherish his freedom at the expense of his sanity. The burden of guilt could be lifted, and with it, the tension that contributed so much to his drinking, therapy was obviously underway. As this example shows, the patient's negative responses to the direct approach need not be feared, because they can be used to suggest to the patient the idea that their very presence, which, while easy to comprehend, is an indication of where his trouble lies. Let me summarize briefly the points made so far. First, the treatment of the alcoholic must initially focus on his drinking to say this is not to ignore the person or his body. They must always receive attention regardless of the ailment. However, the primary emphasis on the control of the drinking is essential if treatment is to succeed. Second, the patient's reaction to direct treatment not only do not undermine the therapeutic relationship, but may actually enhance it. As those reactions are discovered and faced, a solid foundation for a good therapeutic experience is created. To act otherwise can only result in confusion. Before closing, a few comments are in order. First, the importance of timing cannot be overemphasized. The patient who reacted well to an active technique was ripe for the plucking. He wanted to quit and had been trying to for several years. He was a perfect candidate for the direct approach. Actually, he was at the end of a very long trail. It began with his drinking blithely and unconcernedly. It was nearing its conclusion, hopefully with his earnest desire not to take the first drink. Space limitations prevent my identifying, discussing all the various sections of that trail. Suffice it to say that he could now seek help with no conscious reservations. So I'll stop there for a minute, see if anybody has any comments.
Okay. He's wrapped that up there. You know, good summary. Got to treat the symptom. The timing is important, right? You know, got to get them when they're when they're willing, right? So hitting bottom, he's talked about hitting bottom is essential. One of the factors that he got from AA. Got to focus on the drinking, being an authoritarian, being somebody who's going to stop, play the role of stopping the drinking, might not, far from destroying the treatment, might actually enhance it. Because it's, I think he talks elsewhere about this. I think it's just, you know, it's in line with reality, right? You know, if you try some other approach, it's just not real. You know, you got to stop.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I just came up with that one piece of, like, you know, when someone's desperate, that's the time to kind of get in there.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to continue, actually, such direction?
Sure. Yeah, and this is real important, too, in this whole discussion, because he's, yeah, anyway. Actually, such direct methods can be applied only when the patient is in a receptive frame of mind. A whole paper could be devoted to a discussion of how the patient's defenses must weaken so that he is willing and able to turn for help. To be direct, when it is certain that such an approach will bounce off a shell-proof exterior, is obviously bad timing. It wastes ammunition that could later be effective. Other measures must be used first in an effort to soften these defenses. The direct approach can be ventured only when the patient is sufficiently vulnerable to make its success likely. Okay, so just, you know, we look at the drinking itself as the stopper, you know, and the desperation of hitting bottom. And he's thinking that's not apparent in what he said here. He's thinking about how to wear somebody down psychologically and get them to be vulnerable. And then, but anyway, so another difference. We'll go on. Secondly, what should be the doctor's attitude towards the patient's drinking during therapy? In the platform placed before the patient, I included a wait-and-see plank. This I did for three reasons. In the first place, I did not want to give the impression of acting before I, too, was in possession of the facts about the drinking pattern. If it continued and caused difficulty, here was concrete evidence on which to base a decision about an abuse. A second reason for a tentative approach was the hope that the usual concept of the disciplinarian as dogmatic and arbitrary could be undercut if I adopted a less adamant program. If later on it became necessary to crack down, the patient would not be justified in claiming that these new tactics were evidence of a hopelessly closed mind toward drinking. Which, you know, I might level that charge against somebody who isn't an alcoholic. So, yeah, you know, it's interesting that he's trying to look at how to get around that. One patient tried to puncture that stratagem by ferreting out the reason for the delaying tactics and accusing me of waiting until he had hung himself. Since that was true, I admitted the charge and went on from there. I told him he still had to look at the fact that he had hung himself. Gotten into trouble, I guess. The focus was kept on the drinking problem that he still had to face. The third reason for adopting a non-dogmatic policy was to place myself in the position of being able to discuss the problem of the drinking with the patient directly. Generally, with such delaying tactics, the patient makes an extra effort at control, and as a rule succeeds for a while, after which the condition usually takes its course and the patient gets drunk. At that point, it is possible to review with him his hopes of controlling intake and his consequent disillusionment and renewed awareness of his drinking problem. In this manner, the patient's feeling of need for help is revived and motivation is thereby strengthened. Therapy can best proceed on a firmer footing. Okay?
I don't really have any comments.
Yeah, we got 2 minutes left.
Oh, okay. Well, would you like to just finish up? The chapter, or
there's quite a lot still. Redirect that question. How many people in the direct? Okay, my third comment opens up a vast area. It has to do with the significance of the direct approach in treating alcoholism or any other condition. The full import of this question can only be hinted, but an effort must be made to point out the far-reaching bearing of the direct approach with its stopping attribute. One way to discuss the significance of being direct is to ask the question, how much of the handling of people is of the direct or stopping variety? To my mind, the answer is far more than most of us realize or have ever suspected. More of us meet psychiatrists. As already pointed out, incarceration is a form of direct treatment. It still has its values in certain situations. Its more respectable counterpart, the trip or vacation or residence in a sanatorium, serves much the same purpose, namely that of lifting the individual out of the whirling currents of his everyday existence and depositing him in a setting where he can slow down and stop. One can also wonder at the new therapies. Certainly, shock gives the body and mind an awful beating, which in some obscure fashion perhaps may serve a disciplinary, hence stopping function. Again, the sleep therapies put the patient in an enforced rest and for that time being effectively stop him. Children are told to cut that out and know that they are being stopped. While the routine use of such a phrase is severely to be frowned upon, the teacher or person in authority who cannot use that phrase when necessary is badly handicapped in the performance of his job. Youngsters in the nursery school or kindergarten reveal the need for stopping. Good practice has periods of free play, interspersed with times when the children sit and draw or paint or listen to stories or have rest periods. These quiet times are designed to slow the youngsters down. On occasion, particularly with a new and inexperienced teacher, the class gets too keyed up. And since this kind of excitement is infectious, the class goes wild. It then must be dismissed for the day. The firm hand of the good teacher was lacking, and the children got out of control. Certainly a lot of preventative mental hygiene is of the same stopping variety. We sleep, we play, or take holidays to provide a break or cut in the monotony of continued plugging. We seek avocational interests to change our life pattern. Part of the undoubted value of church attendance arises from the peace and quiet of the religious ceremonies and the soothing atmosphere of the church surroundings. The list is long and could be expanded almost indefinitely. Most rule of thumb therapy is of this sort. To rule directness out because it is not scientific may hamstring our effectiveness as people. Neither was surgery, which is a cut it out technique, too scientific at the outset, but its value was never doubted. Skill and its application advanced until its use is now routine. always, of course, where it is indicated. Yet, obviously, surgery only tackles a symptom, a resultant of infection or tissue change. The surgeon's concern with cause does not hinder his taking appropriate action. Similarly, the psychiatrist should not hesitate to cut in. It should not be just a butcher with a knife, but perhaps more than is the custom, the psychiatrist should assume responsibility for things happening to his patient. He must not fall back on the excuse that his patient was uncooperative or poorly motivated. He must do his bit to shift attitudes so that cooperation is obtained. Sometimes a little discipline, artfully applied, works wonders. To discard it is entirely may deprive one of a very necessary therapeutic resource. We're over time. Shall I finish?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay. Summary. In conclusion, let me repeat what I initially stated, namely that the treatment of the alcoholic must include direct treatment of the symptom. This does not exclude the value of deep insights. It merely rechannels them into an understanding of why the patient blocks from taking the remedy prescribed. The study of causation is shifted from origins to the causes that obstruct the therapy, like the big eagle. As they are uncovered and resolved, not only is sobriety attained, but the inner changes necessary to a sober existence can be and are developed. The truth of this last statement I can only vouch for at this time. In a later paper, I shall try to prove the validity of this claim. In the meantime, this paper will have served its purpose if it has alerted the reader to the dangers inherent in the rigid application of the concept of symptomatic behavior and has tempered his antagonisms to disciplinary measures when properly applied. If it has, the effort to prepare it has been worthwhile. Okay, done. There was something important in that last bit. You shift to an understanding of why the patient blocks from taking the remedy prescribed. The study of causation has shifted from origins to the causes that obstruct the therapy. So, you know, he's not dealing with the origins of the big ego. From his perspective, he's not dealing with why the big ego is there. That would be looking at childhood development or genetic factors, whatever, the usual stomping ground for psychiatry. But he says that the ego is a fact and that we need to treat the ego. So in that perspective, it seems to me understandable when he says that AA is all about treating a symptom. Because the symptom there is the big ego. And, you know, for me, that is the manifestation of the spiritual malady. So I think that actually makes me feel a lot better.
The one thing that kind of I thought of was when they were talking about the inexperienced teacher, and I was thinking about the sponsor, the new sponsor who has gone through the 12 steps but hasn't, like, totally had that spiritual experience and is, and I think that, at least for me, like, my experience with, for a long time going through the steps was with people who hadn't totally had the, an extremely deep spiritual experience. They had some type of experience. But it wasn't the type of experience where every step was bringing them closer to their higher power. Mm-hmm. So that's just what kind of came to me.
Yeah, well, like I said, this one's kind of difficult for me. The next paper is going to talk about is going to be an address to alcoholics at a convention. So we're going to get a different take on this. This talk is all around the web. It's on primetimeisnow.com/library. You can find it elsewhere. But don't do that because he has a terrible voice. His reading voice is just, it's nasal and it's boring and it's much better to read him. So anyway, but if you're interested, you can listen to the talk he gave. But so that's a transcribed talk, and it's more kind of along the lines of what. I think actually I'm going to meditate a little bit on that, the ego being the symptom, because I think that's what he's talking about. That there's some cause for the ego, right? You know, childhood development or genetic predisposition. I've got that up on the website. But having read this, it seems to me it's a pretty important distinction, and it explains a lot of the difference for me between what Thibaut is doing and what AA tries to do.
So any other comments? Lee, would you like to take us out with the Serenity Prayer?
Oh, the Serenity Prayer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How about I do the original Serenity Prayer?
Sure.
God, give us grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed. Courage to change the things which should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, hey, thank you guys.